This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or perhaps how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have done things it's pretty hard to imagine for the sake of our country, for the sake of our freedom, that freedom that we so easily take for granted. We want our veterans to know that we appreciate what they've done for us. We want to honor their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure learn a lot. We're educated, entertained, and even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in San Jose, California, talking to 91-year-old World War II veteran Paul Ferdinandsson. Originally from the Fresno area, he served in the 84th Infantry Division during World War II, and you talk about some close calls. Boy, are we going to hear some stories today. But let's go back to the early days. Your folks were Danish immigrants, huh?
Yes.
What was that like growing up in the Central Valley in a Danish-American home?
We went to the Danish Lutheran Church, which was all, there's a lot of Danes around then, still is probably. We spoke only Danish at home. Our friends were all Danish. When I started grammar school at Fowler Elementary, I couldn't speak English.
Wow.
But, I learned pretty fast.
Do you still remember any of that Danish you learned growing up?
I remember virtually none of it now. I could say a few words, you know, but I don't even know any swear words, I don't think, anymore.
Well, maybe that's a good thing, because I wouldn't know the difference anyway, and we might be in some trouble if someone listens to this on the internet in Denmark. That's a pretty rural area at the time, outside of Fresno.
Right. We lived on Peach Avenue. I went to five different elementary schools growing up.
Why so many?
Because my dad's quite poor. He would buy and lose it or just work for a percentage of the crops. When I started high school, my dad had bought a farm, and we were able to stick with it, had a house built on it, and that's where we were from there on, and that's where I went to Washington Union.
And you were a pretty good athlete for the Panthers of Washington Union High?
I was a good athlete, yes, but not necessarily great. But
you went on from there. You graduated in 1940, went on to what was then?
Radley Junior College for 2 years.
Yeah, and if I'm doing the math, it would have been during this time that the world changed a little bit on you. Do you remember where you were and how you found out about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, there was a few of the fellas that I went to school with. We liked to play poker, and we were at this fellas' place. It was in the evening, and then it came on the radio. We were had the radio on. They attack on Pearl Harbor. We all said, well, we're going to be in the Army soon. And they were right.
Yes, they were. But before that happened, you had accepted a track scholarship to San Jose State?
Yes, for javelin.
For javelin. How'd you get involved in the javelin?
It was in junior college, and there was a javelin, and then I just picked it up and threw it a little bit and got interested in it. And so I started to throw it competitively. Bud Winters was the track coach here in San Jose, who's world famous, supposed to be the speed king guru.
Your javelin career at San Jose State was rudely interrupted by Uncle Sam, who had another weapon in mind for you, I suppose.
Well, let's see. I was at San Jose State just for maybe 2 months when I got my draft notice. I just hit 20.
Do you remember what that felt like? I'm sure you had ambitions, aspirations as a young man.
We were very loyal. A lot of fellas volunteered. I wasn't going to volunteer. I didn't feel bad at all by being drafted. I felt good about it.
I don't know if you can remember this, because now you've lived it all, and some intense months of World War II are in your rearview mirror. But do you remember at all what your expectations were when you got drafted, what you thought the Army was going to be like?
No, the Army and the way it's situated and organized, it reminded me of a football team.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you got this esprit de corps, you know, within your company or platoon or squad that you're in, and it really reminded me a lot of football.
Although I don't think you ever had a football practice where you were crawling under barbed wire with live bullets going overhead or throwing live hand grenades.
No, that wasn't quite it.
But you did experience those in the Army, and I think we should mention that, because some folks today say, what, are you kidding me? They actually were firing live bullets over their heads while they crawled on the ground under barbed wire?
Under barbed wire, and they had wire cutters, and as they're crawling through, they would use their wire cutters and cut the barbed wire so they could get through there easier and faster, which was, I thought, pretty good thinking.
They didn't get caught, huh?
No.
And you're a pretty tall guy, so I imagine for you, with those bullets flying over your head, and this is just training. I mean, you don't want guys dying in training stateside before they even go overseas, but that actually happened in some places.
Yeah, I think I remember crawling through many on my back, because then I'd push the wire up over and took longer, but that was quite an experience.
And you got a feel, too. I mentioned hand grenades, and I bring that up because I think it foreshadows a little bit something we're going to hear about later in your story. In your training, it was extensive enough that you got a feel for the timing of a grenade and how long you might be able to hold it?
Yeah. We threw grenades in practice. Sometimes they were duds, but then we got a chance to throw a live grenade. You'd pull the pin, and as long as you hold the handle down, you know, it doesn't start, then you got about 3 seconds before it'll explode. So you pull the pin to throw it, and I asked the sergeant that was running the drill if it would be okay with him if I pulled the pin and let the handle go. So now I got 3 seconds with that live thing in my hand and throw it. And he said, if you got the guts, go ahead. I didn't have the guts to do it.
Not yet. Give it some time.
But at least I had that experience, you know.
Exactly. And that would be important a little bit later on.
Yeah.
What was it like for you? I know we're glossing over a whole lot of training, and you feel that training really served you well. But when you finally did go overseas, were you anxious to get over there and see what you would encounter?
We were.
Yeah?
Our division was combat ready way before we went over. There were so many casualties taking place in Italy. The army needed cannon fodder or, you know, a lot of privates. So they stripped our division of privates. The army had an ASTP program where they drafted kids that had pretty good education and graded high and tests, put them into college. I guess they're going to build an elite group that way. But then when they stripped our division of privates, there weren't enough draftees to fill us back up again. Well, the AST program was discontinued then anyway, and they filled us up with all these college kids.
Yeah, and I've talked to plenty of those guys who were a little disappointed when that happened way.
They would kind of lord it over us a little bit, but then I'd tell them, well, I had more education than you did in college, so they'd shut up.
When you guys did get overseas, were you starting to get the feeling that this is going to be real now, that this counts, this isn't practice, this isn't a game anymore?
Oh, we were combat ready. We actually were mentally and physically ready to go.
What was that first taste of combat? I know you guys came ashore on Omaha Beach.
Yeah.
Quite a ways after it had been secured.
It had been secured, and we had just broken out, and the race was on for the German border.
And where was that first combat experience for you with the 84th Infantry?
Geilenkirchen. A little city just on the border of the Netherlands and Belgium, where Netherlands has that tip that shoots down a ways between the two countries. We were on instant alert. At that time, I was a platoon guide, which is the second in command of the non-commissioned officers. Platoon has 3 squads, and each squad has a squad leader who's a staff sergeant and an assistant squad leader who's a buck sergeant. And then you have the platoon guide and the platoon sergeant. And I was a platoon guide at that time that we went overseas. Then we were put on trucks for Belgium. Then we marched right next to the German border. That's when another fellow and I, we were on instant alert to go immediately into the front lines. Another sergeant and I, we thought, well, let's just wander around and look around the town a little bit. Got back, roll had been taken, we were missing. We got busted to privates right there on the spot. Within hours, we were into Geilenkirchen and firing away through the city and into the Siegfried Line.
And you, personally, you carried an M1?
Yes.
What else did you have at your disposal?
Well, I had a few hand grenades. Mm-hmm. We'd have, you know, little buttonholes in your shirt or jacket, so we would be wearing a couple of 2, 3, 4 hand grenades. Each squad has a BAR, shoots the same ammunition, but has bigger cartridge, and you hold your trigger finger down, and it would just empty, boom, 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 boom. We had a weapons platoon in the company, and they had the machine guns and the mortars.
Mm-hmm.
So you had three platoons of infantry and one platoon of heavy weapons.
And the Germans had plenty, too. And
oh,
you got
yeah.
a taste of that pretty early on when the 88 started unloading, huh?
Right. We were going through a minefield that the tank crew wasn't aware of, but we were. And one of the fellas, Roger Garst, he ran up and pounded on a tank and tell him, get out of here, get back up, because you're going through a minefield. And then the tank rolled over one, and Roger got wounded pretty good, and he was out of the war. I had him put up for a medal for doing that, and they awarded him a Silver Star, and he deserved it. He didn't think about should I or should I not, he just did it.
And I've read some of the things that you've written down about your experiences during this time with the 84th Infantry Division. And we're talking scrambling through open fields with Germans firing at you. You guys
yeah.
are firing away. Artillery
yeah.
from both sides sailing
both
side. Overhead.
Artillery and a lot of mortars.
Mm-hmm. It sounds extremely chaotic. And as I imagine myself in your shoes, a little scary. Did you ever find yourself concerned that you might not make it back home to California?
I didn't have that high an opinion of myself as a human being. I don't know why, but no, it didn't bother me at all, really. Of course, when one lands close to me, I kind of react a little bit. But
and that happened pretty early on, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about it.
We were going through the Siegfried Line. You know, they have all these pillboxes, and you've got those little domes on top of them to deflect artillery and direct cannon fire. We would attack them with tanks. The tanks would roar up close to them and then fire shells into the apertures and flamethrower, and that would usually cause the Germans that are inside the pillbox to surrender. During one of those times, we were moving pretty quickly, and the Germans fired a 88 cannon and hit the pillbox right beside me. It was like a blindside hit in football. I just got up laughing.
So it knocked you to the ground?
Knocked me to the ground and completely obliterated one of the fellas in our platoon. He was completely, there was nothing left of him. The shell got him that good, and got several others. So that was really my first experience with the 88.
Well, I could see how that would get your attention.
It sure did. Now, we figured it was the best gun in the war, was that 88.
Yeah, certainly did more than its fair share of damage. And I know this isn't easy to talk about, but when that happens, you get knocked to the ground, you get up and realize there's another guy and there's nothing left of him. And that's a guy that you've trained with that
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
How does that affect you? How do you deal with that?
You obviously feel a little sad, but you get so used to it, you know, it's no big deal.
Do you allow yourself to think that could have been me?
Yeah. But I wasn't, like I say, I was kind of unusual kind of a person in that way. It didn't bother me a heck of a lot. I was lucky.
Did you always believe you were going to come home?
Yeah, I did.
Why?
I'm alive. Till they get me, I'll still be alive and kicking.
Was that just a self-confident thing? Did it have anything to do with American pride, your faith, anything that really strengthened that resolve for you?
I think I was just born to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really bother me. Well, I all of us did. We kind of prayed for a wound that would not kill us or lose a limb or anything, but that they would be evacuated to a hospital and we're through with combat.
That million-dollar wound.
That call a million-dollar wound. Everybody would be happy to have one of those.
That never happened for you, but you did see some guys who tried to create that scenario for themselves, huh?
Yeah, well.
Inflict the wound themselves?
Yeah, we had a guy in our platoon shoot himself in the foot, and he got out. We just called it an accident so that they wouldn't court-martial him. And so this was fairly common.
Mm-hmm.
Guys would shoot themselves in the flesh of their leg and get out.
Well, you never did that, although the Germans almost did it for you. We're going to zero in on some of those close calls with 91-year-old Paul Ferdinandson of San Jose, California, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. a sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.